kind of Islam that Imam believes in is anti-corruption and is opposed to giving privileges to certain individuals. The things that are revealed in the area of corruption in some sectors today are definitely the opposite of what Islam wants. Islam is a religion that fights against corruption. An Islamic government is a government that combats corruption. Such a government is also anti-reactionary. Reactionary meaning contaminating life with old regressive thoughts and drifting away from new Islamic thoughts. Those of our magnanimous Imam. Islam is hostile to aristocracy and advocates the underprivileged. Islam does not favor class inequalities, the gap between the poor and the rich. Late in his blessed life, a few months before his demise, Imam writes a letter to an official saying, "You should show that our people rose up against oppression, chaos, reactionary attitude, and retro-regressive ideas, and that they replaced a monarchic, capitalist, eclectic, and in some, an American Islam with an original Islam introduced by Muhammad."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Trump era tariffs on Chinese imports are fueling record U.S. inflation and threaten President Joe Biden's chances at 2022 midterm elections. We now present you an article written by David P. Goldman. The piece is titled, U.S. Business Pushes Biden for a China Trade Deal. article has appeared on the front page of AsiaTimes.com website. Never before in U.S. political history has the whole of the American business community, more than 30 major business organizations, spoke with one voice, as it did in an 5th of August appeal to the Biden administration to eliminate tariffs on imports from China. No entities in American politics are timider than business lobbies, most of whose work involves quiet lobbying for administrative relief and legislative tweaks. Such a high-profile intervention suggests that the business organizations believe that a deal is already underway. A deal is likely because inflation could poison the Democratic Party's chances at 2022 midterm elections and return control of the U.S. Congress to the Republicans. Cutting tariffs is the quickest way to reduce inflation. Beyond the arithmetic of electoral politics, consensus is emerging that the technology sanctions that Trump imposed on China have failed and may even have backfired. More than 30 business groups, including the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the Semiconductor Industry Association, as well as retailers, farm and manufacturing representatives, asked President Biden to cut tariffs and restart trade talks with China. The letter stated, "A worker-centered trade agenda should account for the cost that U.S. and Chinese tariffs impose on Americans here and at home and remove tariffs that harm U.S. interests." Recently, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told the New York Times that tariffs hurt American consumers. Since then, former President Donald Trump imposed a 20% tariff on roughly half the goods America buys from China. The Treasury Department has collected about $100 billion in fees. Most of that was paid by U.S. consumers. Tariffs explain part of the explosion in durable goods inflation during the past year. Consumer prices for durable goods fell steadily between 1995 and 2020, mainly due to lower costs for electronics. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, for durables fell by 25% between 1997 and 2020, before rebounding by 15% since the COVID-19 lockdown. Falling prices for U.S. imports from China had a big impact on the prices Americans paid for durable goods. According to a Vox Data for Progress poll released on 3rd of August, inflation is the most pressing economic issue for American voters. The United States now imports about $550 billion a year from China, or almost a quarter of America's manufacturing output of $2.4 trillion on a GDP basis. Tariffs of 20% apply to about half of Chinese imports, so by simple arithmetic, the elimination of tariffs should reduce the cost of durable goods in the United States by a bit over 2%. Renmin University professor Jin Kan Rong, a prominent Chinese academic closely followed in Washington, argued recently that inflation could bankrupt the U.S. federal government by boosting the cost of interest on the federal debt. He added that the U.S. needs China's supply chains to keep inflation under control. China's state-controlled English-language newspaper, Global Times, commented on 6 of August, "U.S. high tariff policy is against the trend of the times and will not hold for long. Chinese companies have generally adapted to the new situation, while the U.S. is suffering more from the tariffs than China. This has gradually become a consensus in U.S. public opinion, and this has given China better conditions to maintain its strategic focus. In fact, it is also an increasingly clearer manifestation of China's comprehensive strength. Meanwhile, an increasing number of American strategists have concluded that former U.S. President Donald Trump failed to slow China by cutting off access to high-end semiconductors made with U.S. technology. Asia Times recently was the first to report that China had the semiconductor capacity to work around American sanctions for critical applications, such as 5G network build-out, and that China was moving rapidly to exploit fifth-generation in a wide range of industries. China will build nearly a million fifth-generation 5G base stations this year, vastly outpacing the rest of the world combined. Moreover, Chinese industry sources report that tens of thousands of dedicated fifth-generation networks for factories, ports, warehouses, mines, and urban transportation systems will be installed in the course of the next year. In a July 2021 report on China's semiconductor industry, the U.S. Semiconductor Industry Association wrote, "Just recently, China sent astronauts into space to board a new space station. Earlier this year, China landed a rover on Mars." Chinese state media reported that inside both China's space station and the Mars rover were 100% indigenously designed and produced semiconductors, signaling China's increasingly sophisticated microchip capabilities. Nevertheless, while China has mastered some chip technologies, its commercial semiconductor industry is still relatively nascent. Still, the Chinese government is making serious efforts to close the gap, investing well over $150 billion from 2014 through to 2030 in semiconductors. Buoyed by a booming market and these government investments, China is poised to be increasingly competitive in some semiconductor market segments. In a 4th of August commentary for Project Syndicate, Harvard professor Graham Allison and former Google chief executive officer Eric Schmidt warned, "Most Americans assume that their country's lead in advanced technologies is unassailable, and many in the U.S. national security community insist that China can never be more than a near-peer competitor in artificial intelligence. In fact, China is already a full-spectrum peer competitor in terms of both commercial and national security artificial intelligence applications. China is not just trying to master artificial intelligence, it is mastering artificial intelligence. The pandemic has offered a revealing early test of each country's ability to mobilize artificial intelligence at scale in response to a national security threat." In the United States, President Donald Trump's administration claims that it deployed cutting-edge technology as part of its declared war on the coronavirus. But for the most part, artificial intelligence-related technologies have been used mainly as buzzwords. Not so in China. To stop the spread of the virus, China locked down the entire population of Hubei province, 60 million people. That is more than the number of residents in every state of U.S. East Coast, from Florida to Maine. China maintained this massive cordon sanitaire by using artificial intelligence-enhanced algorithms to track residents' movements and scale up testing capabilities while massive new healthcare facilities were being built. Asia Times broke the story of China's use of artificial intelligence for pandemic control on 3rd of March 2020. China suppressed COVID-19 with artificial intelligence and big data. The Trump technology sanctions haven't slowed down China. On the contrary, as Allison and Schmidt aver, China is gaining on the US and in some fields has overtaken it. Both for economic and strategic reasons, the Biden administration is likely to give Trump's failed China policy a decent burial and move on.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, after 20 years of Afghanistan being occupied by the United States, Afghanis as well as neighboring countries continue to call for Afghan unity and security in that nation, something they have not had since its occupation. Well, the Taliban are on the move and have taken control of three provincial capitals in just one day. What does the future hold for Afghanistan? Is this Taliban the same as those of 20 years ago? And did Washington create a scenario to create more tension and chaos in the country? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight.
The Afghan Defense Ministry has confirmed the fall of Shibir Khan, Kunduz and Saripul cities in northern Afghanistan into the hands of the Taliban, saying Afghan troops backed by local armed forces have retreated as an attempt to avoid civilian casualties.
In the meantime, the Defense Ministry also says that government troops backed by local armed forces are planning to conduct a large-scale attack on the captured cities to retake them from the Taliban. A move that, according to military commanders, needs more time.
In such circumstances, locals here look to the ongoing war as unfruitful. They urge the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the rest of local players to set aside their differences for the sake of people's demand, which is peace and calm.
None of the foreign players can bring a lasting peace to Afghanistan in the absence of a strong unity among us, especially among main players such as the government and the Taliban. They must set aside their differences and work for the sake of people while not relying on foreigners, mainly the U.S.
Many others also believe that there are some secret dealings behind the recent rising Taliban advances. That is why they want some international bodies, mainly the UN, to intervene in an effort to end what they call a proxy war in Afghanistan.
We, the people of Afghanistan, have realized that there are some dirty foreign hands involved in the rising war and bloodshed in our country. That's why we call on the United Nations to intervene and convince the backers of the conflict to stop their proxy wars in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has expanded its attacks over the recent month, capturing over 200 districts in different parts of the country. The militants are gaining more ground despite suffering heavy casualties during their assaults mainly on big cities. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the spotlight, Christoph Horstel, political activist and veteran journalist out of Berlin. And Daniel Lazar, journalist and author out of New York. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start off in Berlin. And Christoph, I mean, what has Washington been doing in Afghanistan for 20 years that when it announces it is leaving, Afghan forces who they have trained appear not to be able to prevent cities from falling in the hands of the Taliban? What did the U.S. accomplish in the country?
Well, that's the big question, next to nothing, as they have the officials all over NATO telling us this now, right now. I have said that a dozen years ago when I wrote my first book on Afghanistan, and we have a very good institution in the U.S. which is called SIGAR, Special Inspector General on Afghanistan Recovery. And they have made, how to say, a whole study costing dozens of millions of dollars, amounting to exactly what I have predicted in 2007. There's a zero outcome for the U.S. They will spill a lot of blood, they will spend a lot of money, billions, and of course they will achieve nothing in Afghanistan, because you cannot, you know, be successful if you come armed. If you come as a friend, it's fantastic. That is what I did all the time in the last 35 years. And that was a very good experience, especially also with the Taliban, where I enjoy friendships, but also, of course, there are people I cannot talk to. That is, how to say, the range of personalities within the Taliban.
Well, Daniel, I mean, your assessment of what is happening in Afghanistan right now, and as an American, aren't you just frustrated with your government for getting involved in this to begin with and spending all this money and basically accomplishing nothing?
Well, yes. I mean, the American government is amazingly incompetent. And remember, Joe Biden was a very early cheerleader of this war. He was one of the most enthusiastic voices in favor of it back in 2001. But the U.S. went in for very ill-considered reasons. It claimed to want to destroy al-Qaeda, but it let Osama bin Laden slip through his fingers when they had him cornered in Tora Bora near the Pakistani border. And the U.S. poured trillions actually, into that country. But the only effect was to raise corruption to absolutely unheard-of levels. So now the country is weaker than ever, and the post-American regime is collapsing faster than the post-Soviet regime did back in 1992. So it's really the post-Soviet regime lasted 3 years, whereas the current regime is lasting barely 3 months. It's really astonishing. The country is weak, it's fragmented, it has no sense of self-confidence or legitimacy, and it's crumbling at a rapid rate as the Taliban advance proceeds.
Well, Christoph, you said that you have gone to Afghanistan several times and spent time there. Let's talk about that, because is the Taliban today different from the Taliban of 20 years ago?
Yes, of course they are. There are, of course, a lot of the leaders which are still in charge. That is clear. But there are very tough lessons which the Taliban had to learn back in 2001. And I think they have learned them. Of course, you know, this is Afghanistan. This is a very, very poor country. Still, we have more than 80 or 85% illiteracy in this country. And that is something you cannot overcome so quickly. And of course, there is no administration to be fixed that quickly that will make Afghanistan one of the, I would say, usual countries. So Afghanistan is special, will remain special for a lot of time. But of course, now you can talk to the Taliban. That is something interesting. Donald Trump has tried it with his people. He tried quite well. And it was, by the way, in 2007 that the German chancellor wrote to me and they said, the suggestions you made in your book will be heeded. I was very angry to hear that, because my idea was that we very quickly arrange a withdrawal from Afghanistan with all our bloody NATO troops. They have lost nothing there. They have no reason to stay there. All the stories were wrong. The CIA did 9/11 themselves and things like that. And now I see how quickly that crumbles. I have predicted that there's no stability in Afghanistan, which we could have, I mean, NATO or the US or Germany could have installed there. That's the story. The Taliban have learned their lessons, and we will find out in the next months and years how deeply they have learned them and if there's a coherence within the Taliban, both regionally and politically. That's a very interesting question, and nobody, I think, can answer that right now, and I think the US will do their usual dirty game with their dollar bags and try to, you know, raise trouble in the area.
Well, Daniel, there are some analysts as well as regular Afghan civilians that are saying that the U.S. made a deal with the Taliban and that government forces in many areas are simply pulling back and allowing the Taliban to take over. Your take of this analysis?
I'm not aware of any deal. I'd be very surprised if there was. It's possible, I suppose, but there's no evidence that I've seen in favor of it. I want to stress one thing. The CIA did not cause 9/11. 9/11 was caused by Al-Qaeda with apparently significant backing by certain elements of the Saudi government. It had nothing to do with the CIA. And I also assume the Taliban, I have no reason to disbelieve this, but I assume the Taliban is the same profoundly reactionary force it was back in 2001. And so therefore the outlook for Afghanistan is extremely grim. The U.S. has made things worse, but I'm not convinced the Taliban will make anything better.
What about that, Christoph, what Daniel was saying is basically the prognosis in Afghanistan is very dim. Your take on that, because you said that there has been a transition between the Taliban of today and 20 years ago.
That's some kind of prophecy which is being raised from a country which is doing its level best let chaos stay within Afghanistan, because there's a very simple question at hand. What happens to the U.S. if Iran and China shake hands and build a double pipeline of oil and gas between the two countries and maybe even include India into the deal? That would be terrible for Washington. That's their greatest nightmare, and therefore they think the only chance they got is to make Afghanistan so crazy that no pipeline will ever stay in this country. So this is the real business behind all this big talk. And I think the Taliban are now quite able to, maintain as much calm if the U.S. is not disturbing them too much to have that pipeline realized, and that would be something fantastic.
So you're saying, Christoph, that the United States wants chaos to reign basically in Afghanistan?
Of course they want to do that. They have done it in the past. They will try to do that now, and they will use their bloody dollar bags to achieve that. I have seen their officers run around with, you know, with these plastic bags filled with bundles of $100 notes, and that is the business going on. It will continue. Of course, they have some friends among the Taliban, but they have some friends among all the factions and fractions of political life in Afghanistan. But not to be in touch with the Taliban, of course, would be very bad for all of Washington's goals in this country.
What about that, Daniel? Do you think that the U.S. has a plan to expand the chaos there, as it definitely knew the capabilities of both the Afghan army as well as the Taliban?
Well, the U.S. has created chaos. There's no question about that. But the U.S. has no plans, because the U.S. has no plan. It's an irrational force, a nihilistic force that has no idea what to do, and it certainly has no idea what to do now after its 20-year effort in Afghanistan is crumbling rapidly before its eyes. I mean, this is the greatest defeat the U.S. has experienced since Vietnam in 1975. It's a devastating blow. The U.S. is being shut out of all of Central America, which is now apparently in the hands of Iran, Turkey, Russia, China, and Pakistan. But the U.S. is nowhere to be seen. It's a devastating strategic setback. And the idea that somehow the U.S. is still in control, is still directing things behind the scenes, I mean, that's just ridiculous. The U.S. is, the U.S. is at a loss of what to do. It has met with profound failure in that country, and Afghanistan will wind up worse, not better, as a consequence.
What do you think, Christoph? The U.S. is still saying that it's going to use its B-52 bombers and it's going to support the Afghan forces. Do you agree with what Daniel said, or is there a plan by Washington in what it's doing and what it has done now?
Well, certainly Washington has plans for each and every corner of this world. And it is very clear that their plan is, well, we cannot keep Afghanistan under our occupation all the time. It's simply too costly. And therefore, they go back to this, chaos plan, that if they can't rule it, if they can't use Afghanistan, if they are no longer the big winners from the huge heroin business, then, of course, it is necessary that they help create this chaos. This doesn't mean that they control the chaos. It just means they introduce it whenever needed, whenever there's too much or too strong order growing in Afghanistan. Then they will try to destroy it. Then they will try to create, problems between the people. That's a business they love and understand, and they keep Afghanistan away from development. And hopefully, of course, they can, pay some of the Taliban to kill some Iranians, as they have done in the past in Iraq. Iran has been very able in the past to establish much better diplomacy with the Taliban in the recent years. But of course, this is nothing Washington is very happy about. So if we remember that before 2001, the plan in Washington was to encircle Iran and make sure that by occupying Iran, NATO would close, the big eastern Iranian part, and then they would simply need something in the north, which then utterly failed later on, to complete the circle around Iran. So this has completely failed. This strategy is dead, stone dead. But what they can do, of course, our American friends, unfortunately, is playing this chaos card. And that is something they are good at. They are doing it everywhere, whenever they cannot rule. And this is what will happen to Afghanistan in the time to come. And it will need a lot of, resolve and cooperation from the side of China and Pakistan and Iran, regional powers. Russia will be introducing itself into it, and see whether they can, as regional forces, evict American chaos agents from that area.
Daniel, what does all of this mean for the Afghan government? As you're saying, post-Soviet, when the Soviets departed, it took at least 3 years, but the situation seems to be moving quite rapidly. Your analysis of the Afghan government in all of this?
Well, the Afghan government has shown itself to be incredibly weak. I mean, far weaker than the government the Soviets left behind in 1989. It's really dramatic. This government is just crumbling in a matter of months. The Taliban advance is accelerating. The government has shown itself to be just so feeble. It's incredible. So as to what happens from this point out, I mean, I don't know. I assume that the Taliban will eventually march into Kabul, will install their reign of power from one end of the country to the other. The question is whether fighting breaks out between the Taliban and its fellow jihadis, the Al-Qaeda and ISIS, who have also established a major presence in the country. So whether ISIS, whether the Taliban can actually bring order is questionable, and whether this is simply the opening stage in a new process of civil war is unknown.
Christoph, your analysis of that, what Daniel just said, whether the Taliban could bring stability and unity in that country.
They can do much better than it is now. That is quite clear. It remains to be seen how much simply the U.S. want to invest into chaos in Afghanistan. That's a question. There was a saying in the NATO occupation time in Afghanistan that you cannot buy Afghans, you can lease them. So there's some truth to this due to the terrible poverty in this country, which, of course, the Western alliance wanted to remain, because as long as they are poor, wages are low. So that is the situation. They will try to maintain this. I think the Taliban leadership is very well aware of what happened in the past 30 years in Afghanistan, and they will find their ways to, kick out chaos from Afghanistan as good as they can. They will take some time. It's easy to make this very weak and artificial government run away, but it's not so easy to establish order and to rule the country orderly. They have made progress, as I said, but I think it's not big enough to achieve order soon, and there will be a huge problem that a lot of those neighbors, Iran, Pakistan, and China, mostly China, I think, they will try to tell the Taliban what to do and what not to do, and that's the wrong way with the Taliban. This is what I can say. There are other ways to convince them, to win them, and then install something good. But unfortunately, policy usually does not strive for something good, but for some gains. And that makes it a very difficult business in Afghanistan. And that, in fact, is the biggest enemy of order.
Daniel, I mean, Iran is actually calling for the end to the occupation in Afghanistan, along with security and unity of the Afghan people. In your perspective, what would it take to reach those goals?
That's a very good question. I have no answer, actually. The Soviet Union went in 1979, late 79, with an attempt, with a very flawed program, but one that aimed to bring the country, into the modern world. And it was defeated by mainly U.S., Pakistani, Saudi imperialism, who armed the most bloodthirsty and reactionary elements in the country. And these bloodthirsty and reactionary elements are the ones who the U.S. then propelled back into power in 2001 when it invaded Afghanistan. And so no surprise, the government that the militias formed is weak and corrupt and fractious in the extreme. Now, Afghanistan is a broken country. It's been torn by 40 years of warfare. It's been devastated. What the outside world has done to it is one of the great crimes of the modern era. I doubt very much the Taliban can somehow repair the damage. I'm sure they will merely compound it. But putting Afghanistan back on its feet, introducing a note of economic development, providing for some kind of degree of progressive social reforms, that will be extremely difficult in the years to come.
Okay, well, of course, we're keeping our eyes on Afghanistan and fingers crossed. I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. I'm Berlin, Christoph Horst, political activist and veteran journalist, and out of New York, Daniel Lizat, journalist and author. And as always, we appreciate you being with us here on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for staying with us, and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The city is surrounded by flames. Underground, there are tales of heroism and fear for the future. Little had prepared any of us on the Athens-bound flight for the sight of the great fire-induced clouds that swept either side of the plane as it made its descent on Friday, 6th of August. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Helena Smith. The piece is titled, Apocalyptic Scenes Hit Greece as Athens Besieged by Fire. City is surrounded by flames. Underground, there are tales of heroism and fear for the future. Little had prepared any of us on the Athens-bound flight for the sight of the great fire-induced clouds that swept either side of the plane as it made its descent on Friday, 6th of August. News of the extreme heat engulfing Greece had spread beyond its borders all week, packaged in increasingly desperate language. Temperatures were breaking records few had ever imagined. If Monday was bad, then Tuesday was worse. In some parts of the country, the mercury had hit 47 degrees Celsius, 117 degrees Fahrenheit, with thermal cameras on drones recording the ground temperature in downtown Athens at 55 degrees Celsius. By Wednesday, 4th of August, we were hearing that entire tracts of suburban forests on the Greece capital's northern fringes had gone up in flames. Infernos seemingly redolent of Dante's hell had incinerated everything in their path. Friends had lost homes, thousands of people had been evacuated, with residents and tourists fleeing blighted zones by any means possible. Terraces and Athenians' respite against the blazing heat had been transformed into ash-laden no-go zones. It's been crazy over here. Between the extreme heat and the wildfires, it feels apocalyptic. Eleni Myrivili, a friend recently appointed to the role of Athens' first chief heat officer, wrote in an email on Thursday as the army was deployed to assist firefighters. ash is raining down on us here in Athens. From the sky, it was frighteningly clear that the city was under siege, caught in a cycle of insufferable heat, fueling conflagrations on terrain so parched it was ready to ignite at any moment. Fires, some big, some small, some extinguished and then rekindled, were raging nationwide, the country's civil protection chief, Nikos Hardalias, told reporters. Conditions were not only extremely dangerous but unprecedented, he said, estimating that firefighters trying to protect populated areas, electricity installations and historic sites had battled 154 wildfires over the space of just 1 week. More than 60 conflagrations were still raging on Saturday, 7th of August. Over the past few days, we have been facing a situation without precedent in our country in the intensity and wide distribution of the wildfires and the new outbreaks all over Greece, he said. I want to assure you that all forces available are taking part in the fight. Under skies of acrid smoke so dense, authorities urge residents to wear face masks outdoors and close windows in their homes. Other nations, including Britain, have stepped up to help this weekend, dispatching waterborne planes, firefighters, and vehicles to Athens. Although temperatures had dropped after 11 days of exceeding 40 degrees Celsius, winds also picked up on Friday, fanning new flashpoints in and around Athens. Saturday, 7th of August, a huge blaze that had burned through forests and houses towards Lake Marathon, Athens' main reservoir, was advancing up the slopes of Mount Parnitha, surrounding a national park regarded as Athens' last substantial green lung, and sending yet more choking smoke across the Attica Basin. On Evia, the island east of the capital, where wildfires have also rampaged from west to north across rugged woodland, dramatic scenes unfolded as ferries, tourist boats and fishermen rushed to evacuate more than 1,000 people from seaside villages and beaches. Men and women could be seen clutching babies and carrying the elderly and vulnerable on chairs as they boarded the ships to safety. Further south in the Peloponnese, emergency services struggled for a fifth straight day to contain wildfires that have destroyed large parts of Ilia and Messenia and threatened ancient Olympia, where the Olympic flame is lit every 4 years. Mindful of the huge loss of life from wildfires that tore through the seaside resort of Marti in the summer of 2018, the Greek government has prioritized evacuations. Two deaths linked to the latest wildfires have so far been reported. One victim was a volunteer firefighter and the other, Konstantinos Michalos, the British-educated head of the Athens Chamber of Commerce and Industry, who was found dead after rushing to his factory as a devastating wildfire advanced on Krioneri, a suburb in northeast Athens. Greece's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, said climate change was clearly to blame for temperatures that have turned the country into a powder keg and sparked infernos described as the worst in decades in neighboring Turkey and Italy. Athens is the hottest metropolis in mainland Europe, with meteorologists predicting that annual mean temperatures across the Mediterranean Sea will increase by up to 2 degrees Celsius over the next 30 years. But in the midst of darkness wrought by nature gone awry, extraordinary stories of valor also emerged last week. Faced with the prospect of his home in Thraco Makedones, in the foothills of Mount Parnitha, being raised by fire at 3 a.m. on Saturday, Alexandros Rizos decided to stay on and defend his property. His wife and child safely evacuated. The 55-year-old business development consultant stood on the roof of the two-story building, hosing his garden and the tops of pine trees in anticipation of the blaze approaching. "I'm very attached to this house," said Alexandros Rizos, an avid marathon runner, recounting the drama which took place after four sleepless nights. "I hid when the order arrived to evacuate, and when the fire came, it came like a typhoon, raining gold everywhere. I was there alone and very frightened, but I had also taken every measure. I had cleared the garden, removed pine cones. The typhoon lasted for about 4 minutes, but the grass outside and the treetops were wet enough for the fire to pass over." The appearance of the firefighters minutes later and his own heroic efforts saved the entire neighborhood from being reduced to cinders. Like many, Rizos believes the climate emergency will only get worse. "We're ecologists, we love nature in my family, and we want to protect the environment, not install air conditioners that will destroy it. But with temperatures of 45 degrees Celsius, that's going to be hard. We have to adapt, for sure, and replacing pine trees with other trees that don't burn so easily." Mayrevili fears the effects of the destruction of so much forest around Athens. Mount Parnitha is a hub for biodiversity and home to some of Europe's richest flora and fauna. "These mountains around Athens are our life support," she said, describing the challenge to mitigate heat as a battle of all battles now confronting Greece. "We've taken a huge step back. A vital part of our green infrastructure has gone. With all these trees no longer there, we'll be faced with new climate conditions and have higher temperatures and likely floods in the metropolitan area of Athens for years to come."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.